Catherine Ann Wynne, reading now from her four-volume speculative novel series on Simon de Montfort, founder of Parliament.
Simon has been tortured by King Henry of England for treason and has been rescued by King Louis and is in France and has been permitted to visit Louis at the palace. He's quite crippled. After seeing Simon seated in a chair plump with cushions and pouring wine for everyone, a diluted goblet only for himself, Louis, to spare the invalid a lengthy visit that could tax his meager strength, at once opened the issue on his mind. "We rescued you from England because we know the treaty funds we granted to King Henry for troops to fight Manfred's Moors in Sicily were spent instead to raise armed forces against his own subjects and their parliament in England." Of course, Joinville cocked his head to one side. Joinville, King Louis's young steward, is present also, and so is Archbishop Foulkes, Louis's confessor. Foulkes is soon to become Pope.
Just a few lines, Catherine, set down in and around 2010, to draw us into the fascinating but largely underexplored life of the 13th century founder of the British Parliament. Her research has been exhaustive, and we should note details such as this one: as the new form of government is being drafted and officially recorded, she writes, "The Assembly's clerk inscribed on his wax tablet the radical reversal of the flow of government beneath the heading, Provisions Made at Oxford." We might certainly pass over the fact of the inscription on the wax tablet capturing this historic occasion, but we might also take it as a sign of the power of the written word in the history of the world and for Catherine Ann Wynne as an author herself. Her recent book, titled A Cabinet of Dreams, that's where she explores the power of words and asks, where do a writer's words come from? And in a moment, as she read a bit from the Montfort series that we just heard, she's given us something of what she's come to believe. It was 1977. I was writing The Fairy Garden, a passage that took place at Salisbury Cathedral at the time of its consecration. My pamphlet from the cathedral, when I visited there the summer before, said the year was 1258. What was happening in England in 1258? I hauled out my Britannica. It told of the Barons' War, led by Simon de Montfort. I'd never heard of it or him. I looked up Montfort. Most biographies I'd read in the Britannica were straightforward, nonpartisan. But this, on Simon de Montfort, angered me. The word that came to mind was calumny. Even at that moment, I thought my reaction very odd. Here was I, who knew nothing of this man, doubting, even being enraged by the authoritative Britannica. Perplexed by my reaction, I set the matter aside and went back to writing the fantasy novel, The Fairy Garden. A friend was involved in the restoration of the Ottendorfer Library, a little local branch of the New York Public Library system. A devoted user of the big library at 42nd Street and the New York Society Library, I'd never been to the Ottendorfer, but a couple of weeks after my disagreement with the Britannica, I attended the reopening of the Ottendorfer. Standing at the rear of the room and sipping a lurid red punch, I gazed at the ranks of stacks arranged in a herringbone pattern down the center aisle. A couple of feet of the end of each stack was visible from where I stood. I'm quite nearsighted, but my eye was caught by a set of green-bound books quite far away. I walked up to them, took a volume off the shelf, and let it open to a page at random. That page described the death of Simon de Montfort at the Battle of Evesham. The author had high praise for Montfort. This was Green's history. I shut the book and said, my next work will be to write about Montfort. I had no notion that Simon de Montfort would occupy my thoughts, obsess me, for the next 35 years. That night, as I was about to fall asleep, I heard a conversation. It was in old French, yet I understood the words. I did not understand what these people were talking about, but I wrote down what I heard. Translated to English, the dialogue is otherwise unchanged from that night's dictation and found its way into my Montfort series. From that prologue, we are able to distill examples of three principles Catherine examines in her recent book, A Cabinet of Dreams. Research. She spent over three decades immersing herself in the life and world of Simon, as she tells us. Dreams, her dream, in Old French, is just one example of the way a writer might be influenced by dreams. And a very important word to her, vision. She writes, "Only now, rereading The Fairy Garden, do I realize that it is not just a fantasy novel that saved me when I needed it. It is about the advent of vision in my writing." Catherine Ann Wynne, award-winning author and screenwriter from Wayne County, paid a visit to the WVIA Benko studio to talk with us about her passion for words and the stories they tell. You have been a writer for ages, and you have written all manner of books, historical books, plays, radio theater, these pieces. You've learned something in that about writing, and you're a reader par excellence, so you feel that you have something to say and wanted to say it in this book.
Well, yes, you know, writing stage plays was a huge help to me in writing novels, because with a stage play, what you're telling the actors to do actually has to be possible to do. And that is a very good key to writing a novel, that the action, it has to really work. You can't cut corners. But I had a bunch of short stories. I had books published, my Montfort books and so forth. But I had a lot of short stories, short plays, plays that I had done. I had a radio theater company, Jefferson Radio Theater. I think we did 9 different things, and they ranged from, you know, a single half-hour broadcast to a 7-part miniseries, and that just counts as one. So I had all of this material, and quite honestly, I was so sick I thought I was going to die. And I said, well, I got to do something so all this isn't lost. So I started compiling them as a book. But what interested me about them was really, where does a writer get his or her words? My father was a writer, and you'd see him staring off into nowhere, and I couldn't interrupt him because he was working, staring. Well, thinking about it, there are 3 different places writers get words. Interviews, real things, journalism, where the challenge is to try to convey in the abstraction of words, a real thing as close for the reader as to what actually happened or is seen. That's quite a challenge in itself. And as for journalism, it also has to agree with what your editor wants. The second thing is imagination, which is where a great deal comes from. I have an imaginative book here, The Fairy Garden, which is also under Catherine Ann Wynne, because although I wrote it in 1977, I didn't get around to publishing it until 2014. It has a beautiful cover of a fairy offering a fancy jeweled bag to the viewer. But it is a work of imagination, and that's not easy. I wrote an outline, started with that, and then you have to go through all, the empty page is infinite. And you have to narrow down to what is going to serve your purpose best. It's like going through a computer or a card catalog system to come up with the one thing that you're next going to write that serves the purpose of the book best. And that's quite a challenge, and it's hard work. The third thing, you can call it inspiration, vision, whatever. I do call it vision there because inspiration, you know, it's a word that's been around a long time. And what is it? Is some angel reaching down, pointing at the, what is it? So I use the word vision. My best example of the experience, it's something not at all unique to me, is when something simply comes and you write it down. Now, I was commissioned by the New York City Parks Department Historic House Trust to write a monologue play on Poe for the Poe Cottage. So I did the reasonable thing. I did all the research I could, found Poe biographies, read everything of Poe, and was loaded with all this information and had no idea what I was going to write. None at all. Total blank. One morning I woke up, turned to Peter Wynn, who you on WVIA may remember, is my husband. I said, "Peter, don't bother me today. I'm going to write." So I sat down at my computer, and I got up about what I thought was 2 hours later with no idea of what I had written. It was 16 hours later. No idea of what I'd written. I had Peter print it out and asked him to read it. I said, "I don't know if this is even coherent." And actually, it ended up being performed at the Waverly Inn in Greenwich Village as dinner theater, because you listen to or see Poe's life and you get very hungry. He got very hungry. So it was dinner theater with the play first, then the dinner, then the end of the play and dessert. But the opening night, there were a number of Poe scholars who came, and they came to see, "Where did you get this?" They thought I had found some stash of Poe autobiography. Of course, the challenge with this piece was, since there are Poe's poems and a couple of short stories, not the usual ones, but ones that elucidated a point in his life, because he describes to you his life from childhood on. And I found just the right poems to fit in. But what he's saying had to match, and it did. While I was blotto and being his typist, I guess. Now, others do this. Others have this experience. I'm no way unique. A playwright named Romulus Linney. Peter was a New York theater critic before he came here. And we went to see a play called The Sorrows of Frederick, about Frederick the Great. And it was like Romulus was under his skin. It was so intimate and insightful. And I went up to Romulus after the play and I said, "How did you do this? What did you do?" And he wouldn't talk about it. The next day, he sent me a postcard of a torii, a Japanese spirit gate. Now, most authors who do experience this don't want to talk about it because, you know, such things are not in keeping with our materialist, rationalist world. But they do happen. And I'm not willing to say what happened. Oh, I will say that at the Waverly Inn for Poe's birthday, we had a seance. And Poe and Virginia came in, and we asked them, "Well, are you considering reincarnate?" Oh, no, they did not want to have anything to do with what was in our future. The next day, when the people came back around the restaurant, this was in a room with a fireplace that we did the show. The crockery on the fireplace had been taken down and smashed in the fireplace, and their computer was completely bonkers. There was a resident ghost who didn't like it that we ignored him, I guess. There are more things than Horatio imagined.
So in writing A Cabinet of Dreams, then, you have that as a prologue, and you give us some of the samples. They are stories. Anything Poe in here?
Yeah, there's a little excerpt from the Poe thing that's very vivid, I think. It opens with a short story. I may be unusual in thinking that in the hundreds, maybe thousands of years before the last two centuries, the women who had the greatest freedom were courtesans. And I've written of them twice, once in a radio series called The Richest Woman in the Western World, about Eliza Jumel, who was born in a brothel in Providence, Rhode Island, and was a prostitute, but succeeded in marrying a very rich French liquor importer. So she became Madame Jumel. And then the other is, I decided to try my hand at writing a mystery. And I had been quite taken by a real courtesan whose name, well, I never remember whether which is her name and which is my fictional character, Harriet Winslow or Harriet Wilson. But one of them was a real one. And so I wrote a mystery in which she is a courtesan on a very high level, but also a spy for the Regency, Prince George, who becomes King George IV, and also a sleuth. And in this mystery story, well, her partner is a Barbary ape who is costumed by Beau Brummel. And the title of it is Dead Adelaide or Lord Byron's Lovely Corpse. And it's a fun story.
A Cabinet of Dreams also includes something of this region, Johnny.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I won the commission, the Scranton Cultural Center, to write a play on the 1902 miners' strike for the Celebration of American Labor 2000. And I won it because, you know, you had to write up a little example of what you would do, and I ended it. There was a chorus of men and women, miners, but I had this whole chorus come out at the end, and each one step forward and describe everything from the Triangle Shirt Factory disaster up to a current thing where Russian miners were on strike in a mine. That worked wonderfully on paper. Actually, it took too long on the stage, so we abbreviated it. Oh, and apropos of that, our state senator went to the ladies at the cultural center and said, "We don't want anything that's too hard on big business on this." So I gave J.P. Morgan the love scene, and I believe that may be what is excerpted in the book. Morgan does a soft shoe describing what a disaster he was in business when he was young. But then on a ship going over to Europe, he met a young woman named Amelia Sturgis and fell in love on sight. And we have this magical scene. She's never been to Paris. She's so excited. And this moment is so wonderful. And she reaches up and he says, "I want to keep this moment. I want to keep you." And she reaches up and there's a light in her hand. And this is this moment. And he tries to grab it. And she says, "Oh no, it's gone forever. But I want to keep you forever." And she says, "No, you can't." She's dying of tuberculosis. And as they waltz on the stage, she dies of tuberculosis. And he comes forward. He lays her body down, comes forward. By the way, the cultural center is fantastic. It has an asbestos screen at the back of the stage, which opens up to a ballroom. So that's where they had the waltz. And then that curtain comes down. He comes forward and says how he could not open his heart to anyone ever again. He just gave himself $2. And it gives you an insight into J.P. Morgan as a human being, as well as the many insights into the miners, which the play is really all about.
You mentioned that your father was a writer, and I think people would find it interesting to know what writing your father did.
Oh, well, my father began writing as a teenager. He and a neighbor wrote a stage adaptation of Look Homeward, Angel, which was a big success on Broadway. So that determined him that, no, he didn't want to be a lawyer like his father wanted him to. He wanted to be a writer, and of course, more important at that time. And we're talking about the 1930s was the screen. And he went out to Hollywood, didn't make a success right away, actually came back to New York when he got the call. DeMille wanted him. How? We don't know. I have a photograph of his talking with his father in their house in New Jersey as to whether or not he should take the chance of going back to Hollywood. And I guess my grandmother took the picture, but it's in the book. Amazing things that I found I had a photo archive of. So he joined DeMille. When DeMille's favorite writer died, Jeannie McPherson. Jeannie was more than DeMille's favorite writer. She had started with him when DeMille was making movies in a barn. And they made movies together, like a new movie a week. These were silent movies. And his wonderful film of King of Kings, which is one of the most brilliant silent films ever made, he gives her credit for it. But Jeannie then died in 1946, and DeMille looked for a writer, and I think he was looking for a son. And my father really fit the bill. He'd gone to Dartmouth and Exeter, and DeMille had always wished he'd had that kind of... So he went for my father, hoping for, I think, a son. But my father wasn't interested in any social things. And my father started with Unconquered, which takes place in Pennsylvania and is about white slavery in what became Pittsburgh. And then did... I was 5 years old by the time Unconquered was made. And DeMille's little grandson had died. He was about the same age I was. So I was a big favorite. DeMille sat me on his lap and asked me what I thought of Unconquered. And I said, "It's a terrible picture." And he said, "Why do you say that?" And I said, "Well, the star lady and gentleman are going over Niagara Falls in a canoe, and he reaches out and grabs a sapling and drags them to safety to the shore." I said, "That sapling couldn't hold their weight." My father heaved a great sigh of relief because it wasn't a script problem. But I have this lovely photograph that's in the book that DeMille sent me. Now, I have to confess, I was named after my mother, Ann Rita Frank Jr. So to make sure that this photograph went to me and not to my mother, that's how DeMille signed it to me and said, "I haven't seen you lately. Why not?" And I didn't use the Rita or the Junior. I used Anne Frank. And then, oh, yes, there it is. And then there was the Diary of Anne Frank. And so I had a problem with that. I kept my name Anne Frank. I was writing at that until Barney Rossett said to me, "When did you change your name?" He was a beautiful man, had a terrible Brooklyn accent. "When did you change your name to Anne Frank? When you thought you'd sell more books?" He was the head of New Directions Publishing. And I said to myself, "Well, I've got to do something about this." My nearest cousin's name was Ash. And they said, "You can't have Anne Ash. You have to have three syllables." So I was reading Henry V? Anyway, there was Catherine de Valois, and I really liked her scene. So I legally changed my name to Catherine Ash. I'd been thinking, you know, I'll get married. It wouldn't be a problem, but it was. About 3 years after I changed my name, I got married to Peter Wynne. So now I'm writing as Catherine Ann Wynne, but my earlier books are Catherine Ash.
What about this remarkable family? You say it all in the title.
Yes, it's a family, and then in parentheses, probably not like yours. This is this time when I was sick. I had the pillow on my tummy and the computer on top of the tummy, and I did A Cabinet of Dreams. And then I had this archive that came from my grandmother's aunt that went back to the 19th century. My father had died by this time. I had his pictures, and I said, you know, I don't want these to be lost. And I'd had all these stories of the family because I was 12 years old when I left California and went back to live with my grandparents. And we would sit in Aunt Ethel's room and read. She would read aloud, or they would tell me family stories. So I had all this information, and many of the stories are funny. We have all kinds of people in this. It starts with my grandmother's death, because we specialize in comic funerals in my family. And then goes on to a period in her life, which her sisters referred to as Winnie and the Wolves. She went out to Reno to get a divorce from my grandfather, whom she remarried when I was about to be born. And my father had to ask his boss to get the day off to go to his parents' wedding. Anyway, she went out to Reno, and she asked the desk clerk if she could get in on a bridge party, which she did. She played bridge very well. And her partner was, my father swears he was bogus, English lord named Lord Rodney Lindsay, who convinced her the very thing she had to do with a divorce settlement. Now, this is 1930, in the midst of the Depression and so forth, was she should buy a casino, which she did, the Deauville. And, well, she loved being a casino owner in Reno. My father was sent to Hollywood to get the talent. But she learned how to run a business like this. She'd had a tea room before, but this was very different. Also, she dated the local district attorney, who would tell her when they were going to make a raid because she was getting her liquor from Legs Diamond's gang by a fellow named Billy Graham. And she was the only one who visited him in jail. But she was always warned when the raid would be. But she learned how, now I get back to my courtesan thing, but on a rather lower scale, I'm afraid. This lovely woman who had a business down the street in Reno taught her how to run her casino. This woman was named Belle Livingston. Years and years later, I found Belle had written an autobiography called Belle Out of Order. And the business she had down the street was called the Cowshed, and it was a brothel. My grandmother wouldn't believe it, had no idea what a brothel was. And yeah, well, I have to explain this about my grandmother. When she and my grandfather were in their 70s, I found that neither of them had ever seen each other nude. And I said to her, how could that be? You were married for so long. And she said, well, where would be the mystery? Well, the mystery was solved. She loved to go to Broadway shows, and she'd get in the first row center. She went to a show called The Changing Room, which she thought was a mystery about a room that changed. It wasn't. It was about a sports team in the room in which they changed and took showers. So all these nice, burly young actors come running on stage and strip off every item of clothing. And there is my grandmother in the front seat center staring up at them and learning all she never knew.
Catherine Ann Wynn, award-winning author and screenwriter from Wayne County, speaking with us about her writing life and her recent book, Cabinet of Dreams, though that story about Grandma Vera is found in another recent book, A Family Probably Not Like Yours. Also, we have a chance to read The Fairy Garden, which is a fantasy novel, and The Animals of Fernwood, the Montfort series we heard of earlier, the Founder of Parliament series, is also available. You can find out more information, her biography, and a good one, is on Amazon.com, as are her books. That's Catherine with a K, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, Ann, no E, A-N-N, Wynn, W-Y-N-N-E. And information about her books and about her, Amazon.com, Amazon.com.